The people who did the real work here, I got the benefit of just analyzing the data that came after. But these are my co-authors who were really responsible for the real hard, heavy lifting. Dr. Amanda Castell, who's in the audience, Dr. James Peterson, Donald Hitchcock, who developed and maintained the database, Mr. Leo Rennie, who assisted with all elements of the campaign, Marie Sansone, who's also here, who sort of spearheaded and galvanized forces, Tiffany West and Alan Greenberg, for the entire team. And you may have heard yesterday, we're part of a new public health academic partnership between the District of Columbia, HIV/AIDS Administration, and the George Washington University School of Public Health. And so I'm really excited to be part of this. I think, again, this is a great thing that's happening here in D.C. Obviously, this couldn't have happened without the community and all the efforts, and also, of course, the contractual issues. Hopefully many of you, and I'm noticing many of you from yesterday's panel, if you haven't seen the panel yesterday with my colleagues from Washington, D.C., I hope you'll go online and get all of the wonderful slides that they presented. They presented the sexier, more exciting part of the campaign, monitoring and evaluation. I'm going to present the drier, more number stuff. So hopefully you won't be bored. If you get bored, I'll talk faster, and then you'll be less bored. I could do a tap dance if you really need me to. What I'm going to talk a little bit about is the background of the routine screening campaign. I'm not doing too much redundancy from yesterday's panel, but if you have questions, just shout out and one of us can answer. I'm going to talk a little about the background, the state of HIV/AIDS in Washington, D.C., the methods for this study, and why I thought it was an important addition to what's already been done, results in our discussion. Washington, D.C., as you probably all are aware, has a very high HIV/AIDS rate. This is one of the most severely affected cities in the country, and it's a critical health problem. So in June 2006, the Department of Health announced its campaign to screen everyone between the ages of 14 and 84, and that was largely the vision of Marsha Martin, who somewhere is here around APHA, who really thought this was, and she really saw ahead of time the routine screening recommendations that were forthcoming from CDC. This innovative approach really was the first of its kind in the United States. And it was in September 2006, after the launch of the campaign, that the CDC released its own recommendations for routine screening. So I'm going to give you a little bit of information. This is from Dr. Castell's talk yesterday, just to sort of contextualize the HIV/AIDS epidemic here in D.C. and why this is such a critical effort that was undertaken to sort of routinize HIV screening and get people screened to know their status. Between 2001 and 2006, there were almost 8,000 HIV/AIDS cases. 67% of them were male, and 84% of them were black, non-Hispanic. This is hitting a large proportion of our productive members of our society age-wise, with almost 66% of them between the ages of 30 and 49. This is a very severe epidemic here. In addition, about 31% of it is heterosexually transmitted, so this represents much more of a developing country, as we say, than most other countries in the United States. Just so you have a context for this, because sometimes people say there's a city-state problem, and it's hard to compare rates with other states of a smaller area, such as the district. If you look at comparison of, mood lighting, I love that. What? Thank you. I like it. Comparatively, if you look at these data between 2001 and 2005, newly reported AIDS cases in Baltimore, there were 96.6 per 100,000, where in Washington, D.C., there are 117.7 per 100,000. It's a very high rate here in this area. In addition, about 25% of those people infected are unaware of their status. And we see here in Washington, D.C. that about 70% of the individuals who are diagnosed with AIDS are late testers. So they really don't know their status. They're coming into care late, late engagement in care, which has a higher prevalence of mortality and related comorbidities. So this is just one reason, the context, why routine screening here is extremely important. So their initiative had three goals. One was to raise awareness about the HIV/AIDS epidemic here locally by reinvigorating, getting a lot of energy behind the district's response to HIV/AIDS, making it more active, less passive, and reaching not only those targeted communities that we typically connect with HIV/AIDS, but rather reaching the entire population to stop the spread of HIV. A secondary aim was to reduce HIV transmission by people who are unaware of their infection. That's the 25 estimated percent of people who do not know their status. So this is encouraging people who are aware of their HIV status and to make healthy decisions about their lives and to reduce their risk behavior. Finally, to routinize screening for HIV in all medical and community healthcare settings, which has a number of byproducts, one of which is to reduce the stigma associated with testing HIV positive as well as being HIV positive. I'm a behavioral epidemiologist by training, and I can tell you that one thing that's really important is people do risky behavior. They're going to do it no matter what. And so understanding your status is a key ingredient to reducing risk behavior. And so if we don't know people's status, there's risk behavior taking place that could be reduced. So the HIV screening initiative increased the availability of rapid HIV tests throughout the Washington, D.C. Initially, there were 75,000 OraQuick advanced tests that were distributed free of charge to organizations that were conducting routine screening and facilitating linkage into care. There were subsequent more tests released, but I'm going to focus on this initial phase of the routine screening campaign. Probably most of you know, but for those of you who don't, the OraQuick Advance is one of the, it's a really first type of rapid test. It's a swab. It can be done in the field because it's clear waves, which means that you don't have to have a lab. So this liberated a lot of people from having to have a lab setting. So a lot of people could then go out into the field and do non-traditional testing in non-traditional venues. This OraQuick Advance screens for both HIV-1 and HIV-2 in oral fluid, blood, and plasma. Although far and away the most are using the oral swab for the oral sample. So what was great about the district, and you may have heard this yesterday, and you can find their tools on the web, they developed a highly standardized protocol. Inventory, quality assurance, memoranda of understanding, and participating organizations that went through a simple, straightforward process were then allowed to be provided with these free OraQuick tests. Now, anybody who's in the field, these tests are expensive. They don't come cheap to organizations, so this is a huge removal of a barrier to test individuals for HIV. So what I did for this, and again, this for those of you who saw the client-level data yesterday and our ED data and heard this great presentation a moment ago, this inventory data may not sound that exciting to you. But I felt as important as part of the monitoring and evaluation team to look at the inventory distribution, because that looks at the distribution of kits to the community, not only the uptake. So what we did was we looked at between 7/26/06 and 6/8/07, so a little bit shy of a year, we looked at all the inventory data to try to understand what are correlates of deliveries and acceptance of this program. And we also looked at what are correlates of completion of the form. So that is, do certain organizations asking their clients to complete a confidential or anonymous form, is it a barrier to their participation? And if so, how can we remove that barrier? Because we do need those client-level data. We described these using UniBi and multivariable methods, using STATA version 9.SE, and everything was approved by District of Columbia as well as George Washington University IRBs. Just a couple things to note. Because of the largest percentage, about 30% of the test kits distributed were going to the jail, that was removed as a correlate. So we did not look at the jail because that was already the most, and we didn't want that to overshadow the rest of the effects. We did not include, there were a lot of return and redistribution of kits prior to the expiration date. That was not included because the data were not systematically maintained for the returns. Also, we looked at whether the sites, not the prevalence of return of the confidential client-level form, but rather whether they said that they would participate and maintain saying that they would participate in the confidential form. We also did, Dr. Peterson did has done a large amount of ethnographic and qualitative work doing key informant interviews with critical stakeholders, key informants at the HIV/AIDS Administration, as well as the community members. And that work is ongoing as we wrap that up towards the end of this year. So what did we find? Total kits distributed between that time period, again, this does not adjust for the two kits that were returned and re-given back, were 83,604, given to 49 providers, 18 zip codes within this relatively small area, with 238 distinct distributions. There were more kits delivered in the second year, although you'll see in a moment that those distribution weights decreased over time, and we'll talk about that as well. More than half submitted the confidential testing forms, and about 60% of them were medical providers, while about 29% were community-based organizations. This is just a little grid about the organizational type. Health clinics, medical providers, and emergency rooms take the lion's share of who to whom these kits were distributed. You can see there was a relatively stable kit distribution. There were a couple large peaks here towards the beginning, and then it sort of leveled off over time. The mean units per delivery was 351 with a very large standard deviation, so we have a lot of variability in how many kits people got. 2006, actually they requested, the mean distribution per kit, kit per distribution was actually higher, with almost 500 versus almost a little bit less than 300, which is important to note. Probably what was happening at that point was that people were more ambitious and thought that they could test more people than they actually could. So people were requesting and more kits were being delivered, and that declined over time as people became aware of the real volume of traffic that was actually required. In addition, there were many people that, as a response to the incredible media generated around the initiative, many people sought out testing, and that was expected. So there was a sort of a peak in the volume, which leveled off over time. Non-medical had many fewer distributed, and that was significant, statistically significant, than medical organizations. And people who did submit the forms actually had more kits, not fewer. And that was an important question to make sure that that kit wasn't a barrier. So you can see here, this is a regression analysis, that the characteristics associated with kit receipt, this just basically reiterates the above. The medical agencies had more, those people with the forms had more, and that the quarter of entry, it declined over time. And you can see this here, it's kind of hard to see, but you can see this is regression, the fit on the regression models, that it declined over time, and that's just statistically significant, and then it increased over time based on the type of medical versus non-medical facility. Again, the form submission issue is not small. A lot of times as an epidemiologist, we find that people say, oh no, we don't want to do anything if we have to do any paperwork associated with it. And yet, in order to get information, we have to be able to get information. And usually getting some type of form is how we generally go about that. What we found here is that medical agencies were more likely to do the form, which sort of contextualizes with what you presented a moment ago, that you don't necessarily have to have an increased burden of work, perceived or actual, in order to do these types of programs. People don't mind doing the forms. They view it as part of their normal data flow or clinic flow. Over the first 5 months of the campaign, only about a quarter participated in the survey, and that actually increased over time. Non-participation was not associated with kit request, delivery, or return of kits. And in year two, it doubled with more people increased testing and increased participation in the form. And so the use of that form, that data collection form, and I urge you to see Dr. Castell's data slides on that, because it's really exciting to look at those data, the individual level data. It did not discourage participation. There were four distinct zip codes that were more likely to receive test kits than all of the rest of the combined, and that it was higher prevalence of hospitals, clinics, and those participating with mass screening events. During the first 5 months, 8.4% ordered more kits than they wanted. Again, that's probably more likely to either an actual increase in people wanting to be tested, but probably more likely because many of those kits initially were returned. We also see that it may be just that they were more ambitious about what they thought they could do. So qualitative findings, and then we'll just wrap up. The test kits were a major focus of this screening campaign, and it was really an enabler to community-based organizations to be able to actually conduct routine testing and removing the barrier of cost. Besides the media, many of the HIV/AIDS administration and CBO staff stated that the kits were really one key, if not the key, to their being engaged in this campaign. Without the kits, they wouldn't have done it. The free kits continuously emerged and were mentioned as a motivating factor for some campaign partners to stay engaged in the campaign. And the one limitation was that some interviewees, and this is very biased because these are purposive samples and obviously not representative, was that some people felt that for-profit organizations should contribute to the cost, and some people also there was a concern that there was an advertisement for OraQuick Advance, which it wasn't obviously, but that was one concern raised. The medical community was perceived as absolutely vital to this effort, which means that there is acceptance, widespread acceptance of community-based screening in emergency rooms and other health settings. Providers actually liked the 20 minutes or so while you were waiting for the results in order to be able to talk and counsel the clients while screening them. So they actually found that a beneficial patient-provider relationship was enhanced. And one important message is conveying to the clients that this is just a screening tool. This is not a confirmatory test, and these must be followed up, and linkage into care is critical. What are some strengths and limitations? This, again, is an inventory data source. These are not individual-level data. There are no individual-level results here, and these are biased by public health champions. We have people who really believe in this process, so it's biased by those. And the redistributed kits are not part of it, which is a limitation, so we can't actually look at the actual, although it's a very small margin of error for that, we still can't look at that. Still, this is the first analysis I'm aware of that actually looked at the distribution of these data during an intensive campaign like this, and it's really important to identify correlates as well as facilitators and barriers to participating in this important effort. So the screening campaign successfully distributed screening technology to community members, improving the technology and access to HIV tests. Medical facilities were the most common participants, and the requirement of client-level data was not a barrier to participation. Reductions in requests over time were likely due to a reality check of people understanding exactly what volume they actually required. And finally, this program offers the potential to increase HIV testing, reduce prevalence of unrecognized infection, as well as to ultimately increase the proportion of HIV positive persons that are linked into care. And this is a critical effort, and we're going to continue to monitor and evaluate this, and I'm delighted to be a part of this process and project. So if you have more questions, please contact us, and thank you.